I'm Amanda Carpenter, and this is the Sustainable Law Podcast. If you work in the legal sector and you have an interest in the climate, then this podcast is for you. We're not suggesting we have all the answers, but we explore the ideas that don't always make the final text, those that sit inside the square brackets. Today, we're exploring the tricky issue of whether law firms should or shouldn't work for fossil fuels and whether this affects student recruitment and retention. Leading UK and international law firms continue to earn millions from fossil fuel-related transactions, working with some of the dirtiest clients in the market, as well as with the banks that finance them. Meanwhile, law students are calling for action. Will the student spotlight cause firms to think again, or is it hopelessly naive to think anything will change? Do firms care? And when it comes to paying off a student debt, how many new recruits can afford to vote with their feet and eschew the top 50? I'm delighted to welcome my two guests, Sophia Adams-Barty, Global Head of Purpose and Impact at Simmons & Simmons, and Hayley Zarnick, Founder and Director of Law Students for Climate Accountability. Hello both, and thanks for joining me.
Hi, Amanda.
Hi, good to be here.
Hayley, I wonder if I could start with you. You've been the driving force behind the Law Students for Climate Accountability movement, which began in the US and now has a UK branch producing a report for UK headquartered firms. Can you tell me a little bit about what made you start it and what you hope to achieve with the movement?
Amanda, you promoted me a little bit. I was not in the first group of founders, so I had the framework laid out for me. So to give you a bit of background, in early 2020, there was a wave of protests against the law firm Paul Weiss for the representation of Exxon. I think it was students at Yale, Harvard, NYU, and Michigan in particular, protested their recruitment events. And it got a lot of attention because that is just simply not something that tends to happen in the legal world. And folks realized that it was great that people were paying attention. And also, if they stopped there, it would just be one day of headlines. And so they said, well, we know that Paul Weiss is representing Exxon, and we know that there's been tremendous malfeasance in the course of that representation, but we don't know what the rest of the legal industry is doing to uphold the fossil fuel industry. And so they decided to create the first law firm climate change scorecard, which was published in October of 2020. And at the time, the name Law Students for Climate Accountability was sort of the name for that project. It was not an organization. And so they put it out into the world and said, it's great. We were the Law Students for Climate Accountability. They realized people were hungry for this information and decided we need to keep going. And so that was the point at which I was able to connect with the founders and be part of our first group of student leaders. So since then, we've had a couple of other student committees. We're about to be on our fourth iteration. And we've also got our inaugural group of UK student leaders now.
So apologies for the promotion, but I'm sure you deserve it, really. So the UK group, I mean, obviously, most of the students who are involved are volunteers. I think your position is the only formal paid position. Is that right?
The only full-time staff person so far.
Yeah. What kind of impact are you having here in the UK? And from your perspective, do you think firms are listening?
I think firms are definitely listening. And I think it has been actually quite a lot easier to connect with firms in the UK than firms in my lovely home jurisdiction, who I think have been very committed to the idea that they could wait us out and we'd graduate and they would never have to really respond. We're now at the point where they're trying to invite us into a conversation because they realize that that's not happening. But it's been much quicker in the UK, which has been really, really encouraging to me. And I think we've had some very positive conversations. And then sometimes there are firms that we don't hear from directly, but we hear through the grapevine that they're like, oh, we know that the scorecard is going to come out, or we know that they're working on this report and we need to think about what that means for us. So we're still trying to figure out how you measure impact and how you assess, are we impacting the recruitment pipeline? Are the firms now having more conversations about moving away from their fossil fuels work or what it means to really be engaged in the just transition? Of course, those are not conversations that we're usually privy to. But very, very excited to be here with Sophia and hear a little bit about what that conversation looks like.
Sophia, we're not going to set you up as the opposition, but you are, in some senses, the other side of the fence in the sense that you work for a big international law firm. How much impact is the voice of the students through Law Students for Climate Accountability and other networks having on you as a firm? And how much do you think your colleagues listen and care?
So first of all, thank you for inviting me. And I think also for those of us who work in the sustainability fields, thank you to the law students for voicing, right? So I think as someone who believes really deeply in public debate and bringing views to the fore and there being contributions from all of those in society who are impacted by the issues, it's really important that we hear from the generation who, frankly, in my opinion, we are only the custodians of of our planet for in terms of handing it on. So thank you, Hayley, for the work that you're doing. And Amanda, thank you for inviting me to be part of this conversation. So how much are firms listening? How much are they paying attention? I think quite a lot in different ways is what I would say. Professional services, not just law, our only asset is our talent. Right? And that fight for talent, or that talent acquisition, drawing in the best people that fit your values and so on, that's at the core of what really is the value of these organizations going forward. So both subconsciously and consciously, I think they are beginning to hear voices and opinions that are echoing around and are causing people pause. You know, they're causing people to stop and think, this is really interesting. Our younger cohort are thinking differently. And it is true. We certainly within Simmons have had debates and conversations with our staff across different levels. And we do see more vocalization of values and value-driven choices in career. And I think it does matter. Whether or not that's made it into real decision-making across all law firms is another matter altogether. But there is a landing place and people are hearing the concerns of those who are coming into the profession, who want to feel that they're doing something positive and accept that their world will be impacted by the choices that they make, and they want to choose that in a responsible way.
Do you think there's a retention issue as well? Because I can imagine a number of students thinking, I would ideally not like to work for, you know, a firm that has a big fossil fuel footprint, but I have a debt. So I will put my principles to a side for a while. I'll go in, I'll finish my training contract, I'll do a few years, and then I'll consider and I'll move out. Is there a retention losing young people, skilled young people, once they've been trained, because of that wider climate of working in a non-climate friendly way?
I don't have the stats, Amanda. I don't know if that's being borne out, but I can imagine it being true in that people do vote with their feet. From my own experience, when we run training fairs or vacation schemes and those sorts of things, I routinely get asked by that cohort, what is your view on this? What is your position? How do you, as a firm, reconcile that you have a energy and infrastructure team, and how do you feel about the responsibilities you therefore own? And I can see that they're playing into their decision in the same way as actually clients have said, tell us about your environmental credentials and so on. But interestingly, whether or not that's translating into actual, in the client world, buying decisions, and in the student world, and actual career choices, I think it's probably not as powerful a set of stats as you might imagine, just because of the numbers that you've described, Amanda, the imperative to get on the career ladder and get your stripes so that you can then be more impactful in another way might be holding some people back.
Yeah, Sophia, I really appreciate you pointing out sort of those external pressures. That's something that we're constantly talking with students about. And something that I try and highlight in conversations to firms is, you may not see the impact on your recruitment pipeline right now, but that doesn't mean the students aren't organizing internally inside of your firm, that they're not having these conversations. It doesn't mean that you don't have tremendous amounts of people inside of your building that are suffering from incredible amounts of eco-anxiety, which just on a purely self-interested level is going to impact your productivity. It doesn't mean that you aren't losing the folks that particularly are developing valuable skills in ESG, right? So there's areas that are becoming increasingly important to clients that you're going to lose out on that specific talent. Even if you're like, I can't necessarily see a huge impact on the numbers, you need those talented ESG teams. You need the people that are really, really investing and understanding the compliance issues and the environmental issues. So I think there's sort of the both and. Number one, I do think that there's a numerical difference and that that's going to increase. And number two, even if you're not seeing it yet, there's all of these different sort of undercurrents that I think are going to be incredibly important to firms who want to succeed in the long term.
You know, in this currency of law firms, utilization of hours and profit per partner and all the rest of it, the thing that I like to draw out when I speak either internally to colleagues or when I'm talking to peers is the relationship between firms that are able to articulate their values and their purpose clearly and reconcile that with decisions that they make, recognizing that there's gray space, and productivity and engagement. And every analysis of your staff base's engagement and utilization and innovation and ability to really give as much as they can correlates so clearly with clarity of values and the ability for those values to be aligned with the values of the individuals. And where that's disconnected, which Hayley, what you're describing, in other sectors in healthcare, we used to, and we still do probably call it moral harms, the idea that you go to work every day and do something that morally feels like another small cut that dwindles away the willingness to have strong engagements with the delivery of whatever the organisation is that you're working for. And I think what you've just described there, it must be playing out for many.
Sophia, I'm really interested by something you said. Well, two things, really. One, Hayley, it feels to me like your influence is expanding beyond students, and you're now talking about young lawyers who are working, and we need to come back and pick up on that. But before we do that, how do you square that circle, Sophia? How do you answer the question that says, how do you as a law firm justify your value statement and your green credentials with the fact that you are still continuing to contract with fossil fuel and do, I think, billions of pounds worth of transactions year in, year out? However good your purpose statement is, the reality is there are dirty clients and there's dirty work.
So I'm really a bit evangelical about saying this is all about the grey. People are probably really bored who know me. You're like, God, she's on about it again. I've pained over our purpose statement. I don't think anyone else really realised how much pain, blood, sweat and tears went into it to think about every single clause in there. And it's designed to describe a number of truths. So we don't say we are. The language we use is strive. The first clause is around striving. And the second big clause in our purpose statement is actually describing that we own up to the fact that we have a responsibility to people and planet beyond our profitability. Actually, for a law firm, I think that's quite a profound statement. And the reason why I focus so heavily on this point around striving and trying is because I think there's a truth in that, which is our existing book, our existing infrastructure of the firm, our existing talent base, our clients and our profitability, the direct work with fossil companies is probably smaller than it is when you look at maybe the financial services sector, where obviously there's an enabling component of the clients in that sector. That's the current model we're in. And we talk about moving through a just transition in switching off the planet from its dependency on fossil. In the same way, if you talk to all of those who talk about the role of stakeholder capitalism, the idea is not that you just turn off the switch on the existing model that you have and switch neatly to something else. A, it's not workable, and B, you take no one with you. Right. So I'm already in the choir and singing at the top of my voice and as converted as you're ever going to be, but I've got to take a whole organization of people with me on this journey. And my theory of change is one of being able to take the people from where they are today and put them in a place where their impact is less negative. And I'm not going to promise that it will be net positive, but the counterfactual is if we did nothing, it would be worse. So let's do better. And when we get there, we get to think again, how do you get even better again? And that starts from small things. We've put in place a business acceptance policy that forces partners at each point when they're thinking about new matters to consider the impacts around the environment. We've got some red lines around certain things like primary forests, deforestation and so on. And the reason we did that, which is quite a principles-led approach rather than rules, because the first step in change is getting people to recognise they have a responsibility and they have a choice. It's a long game. I know we don't feel like we have long, but the alternative is I take a sledgehammer to the firm, get fired immediately and have no change at all.
But maybe Hayley would say that we need to take a sledgehammer, wouldn't you, Hayley? I mean, I think what Sophia's just described is a really mature and sophisticated approach to trying to take colleagues with you, probably resistant colleagues. But we're running out of time and you're asking in your network for a pledge to say no new fossil fuel. So you are quite a long way from the rather sort of moderate, grade, nuanced position that Sophia's been describing, aren't you?
Well, I think that's very purposeful on our part because we try and remove as much of the gray as possible, right? We understand that there are technologies that, for instance, have been pitched as climate solutions that either we don't see as climate solutions or we think are quite gray. We spend our time focused on fossil fuels because we know that's the source of the problem. And what I love about what Sophia has said is that you're starting small with the matters work. And the problem that I run into in particularly the US, but not just the US, is that folks say, well, you know, anything that we can do is better than nothing. So let's change the cutlery, right? We fix the plates. And that is just not going to cut it, right? Because you can have a perfectly sustainable, incredibly positive building that you're using to put pipelines in the ground. And so ultimately, whatever you've done to reduce, you know, your paper usage or your travel, it's probably not only not useful, but it might be actively negative because it's allowing you to continue to do that work unseen, right? It's allowing that work to go completely unexamined. And so I would say, you know, actually, we're probably closer together than maybe the sledgehammer analogy might suggest, only because I think you're exactly right, Sophia, that we're not going to get firms to shut it off overnight. But I'm not going to start by asking for one tiny step. I'm going to start by asking for the world that I want to see and then say, okay, what can we do to move you in that direction? And if you're ready to stop doing your fossil fuels work tomorrow, great. I want to figure out how we get there. And if you're not, what's the next step, right? Because we can't spend all our time thinking about the cutlery.
And that's the role of activism, isn't it? It's to paint the future that you want. And it's our job for participants in the sector to think about how we play a part in that. The majority of people, regardless of generation, certainly in Simmons, we want the same outcome. In terms of the climate crisis, there is no difference in the end game. I feel that we've got a common cause, and it's folk like me, I guess, in our roles, whose job it is to try and find that bridge between the day-to-day and the world of, you know, Hayley, your activism work.
Can I ask you, related to that, a question about how we support the young lawyers who've gone into those businesses? So those who can't afford to choose to work with a firm that doesn't do fossil fuels, you know, smaller boutique firm, a niche firm, maybe, you know, an activism group like Client Earth here in the UK. So you've got a big cohort of young people who've joined in the last 5 or 10 years who are hardworking, committed, talented, but they're wrestling day in, day out with their own conscience and their own value set and those small cuts that you described. How do we support those younger colleagues to take action in the firm? Where do we stray into that issue of damage to the planet becoming almost like a protected characteristic? You know, you do not have to work on projects that you feel ethically, morally are not right for you.
One of the things that I really advocate for in Simmons was to give everyone voice. And obviously, my remit spans more than the climate. I know we're talking about climate action here, but it's across the S and the G as well. And I think for the older generation of lawyers, of those that came before us, I hosted an event years ago when I was in my last post on ethics and the law, and a very sort of statesman-like person from the legal community in London stood up and said, but Sophia, we were trained to leave our values and morals at the door before we go in. And that's obviously changed. And I think we have to give those who are coming up through the ranks the opportunity to voice their opinion, even if it is not decision-making. The power of being able to tell your truth, to be heard and not to be silenced, is incredibly important to the mental health and well-being of our people. There's entire swathes and programs in law firms dedicated to that. We must make that happen. The counter to that, the difficulty, is law firms remain incredibly hierarchical institutions and quite based on sort of mentorship and sponsorship, which doesn't always build towards having an open speak-up culture. Hayley, you've probably spent a lot of time talking with young lawyers in practice. I wonder what sort of action they would want to be able to take.
Yeah. Going back a little bit, Amanda, you'd mentioned sort of, it seems like we're expanding our purview a bit. And I will just say, we absolutely are thinking about young lawyers and how we engage. Part of the reason why law school is important is because it's the site where non-lawyers become lawyers. And so I will just say, if we've got firm folks listening, that if you're not going to provide your young lawyers with a space to voice those concerns, we will. And you may or may not like the direction that that goes, right? But in terms of what we're hearing from folks and what actions they can take, I think, yes, there's opportunities to turn down work depending upon what firm you're at. I've heard of instances of folks trying to write that into their contracts that they won't do fossil fuels work. And I think that's great. And it's a signal to firms. But I don't think that that is the kind of action that's ultimately going to move the firm away from that work, right? Unless it's a mass action that's organized across the firm. And of course, we're happy to support that where folks are interested. But I do think that the other thing that lawyers can do and that we try and facilitate is have conversations inside of the firm to power map and think about who the decision makers are and what's it going to take for that firm to make a different decision. Because it's not enough for an individual to say, I won't do that work, even though that's something that we absolutely want to see. Not only because that's not going to make the change, but also because it doesn't stop the moral injury, right? If you know that ultimately you are still contributing to the profits of a firm that is using those profits to destroy the planet, you're not going to feel perfectly hunky-dory about it, right? You're still going to have that anxiety. That's the sort of action that we're trying to move folks in the direction of, is connect with people inside of your firms who are allies, figure out who the decision makers are, and think about what's the reputational risk And how can we leverage that? What are the specific pressures that are going to move this firm? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, we know that we are critical to these fossil fuel projects, right? That they cannot happen without lawyers participating in the contracts and arranging the financing and making sure that if litigation ever happens, that the corporation will not ever be held accountable. And because we're so critical, that means that we need to understand and exercise our power in a responsible way.
And that's a mindset shift, right? The acceptance that as a lawyer in the room, you have a power beyond the power of just doing the transaction that you've been asked to undertake. And that's quite a cultural shift. And it goes both ways, doesn't it? Which is there has to be an acceptance within the general counsel community that their lawyers will sit around a table and have values and opinions that they will bring to bear, and not to be scared and run away and go to somewhere else. Oh God, that law firm's full of activists. It's quite a change from where particularly those who sit much more senior in law firms will have experienced.
I am not someone who is so idealistic that I believe we're ever going to get 100% of attorneys on board. But I don't think we need 100% of attorneys on board. And I think if we make it the case that somebody needs to choose to go work for Chevron, to go be Chevron's attorney, if they're going to do that work, that number one, many, many fewer lawyers will choose to do that work. Chevron will still have lawyers, but it'll be more expensive. And there'll be a tremendous increase in representation on the other side. I think if we live in a world where 80% of attorneys are willing to say, I'm not going to do that work and you shouldn't either, that's a tremendously different world. And we're a very, very powerful profession that has our tendrils in every aspect of politics and every room where there's power gathered. And so I think that a supermajority is what we need to build. And because we all have a self-interest in a habitable world, in a water supply, in air we can breathe, in land we can live on, that is incredibly doable if we work together.
Yeah. And this is what's so interesting about the conversation is that it is such a complex, multi-layered solution, isn't it? There's multiple drivers. We've got the clients who are beginning to ask questions. We've got your network, Hayley, your growing network of students and young lawyers and young professionals. We've got people like Sophia really leading the charge internally in organizations and getting organizations to refocus on purpose. The one bit, I guess, of that complexity we haven't talked about is the role of litigation and how much law firms are opening themselves up for potential litigation around their work on fossil fuels. And you just touched on it ever so slightly by saying, you know, fewer lawyers will work for bad actors like Chevron. How important is the litigation question in terms of making those changes happen?
I will say briefly, I can't speak to sort of the pressures internally, but I can say that there's very, very clear indicators that ESG litigation is dramatically on the rise and sort of multiple different pieces that you can look at to find evidence for that. But I would be curious, Sophia, from your perspective, how much it impacts firms.
I think it might differ jurisdictionally as well, actually, where there is a greater culture of things like class actions, where there's greater ability, actually, to your point, Hayley, earlier about parity of arms and access to legal resource to fight for rights. I think that changes. Is it on every law firm's corporate risk register? Probably. How high is it? Is it a material risk? Probably not. Not yet. It will start creeping up. So I undertook our first ever materiality impact assessment. It's a really thorough exercise. I did it as a dual materiality model where I look at the impact on us as a firm, but also the issues that our clients recognize as being important. And I think in the world of the clients, it's higher. And therefore, if you then pass that back down the chain, it becomes a relevant issue, but at one step removed still probably for most, unless you are a firm that does a tremendous amount of this work. For city law firms that have quite diversified portfolios or certainly focused in certain sectors where direct work with fossil fuel organizations is fairly limited, I think it's on the radar, but it's not a big factor in decision making. But Hayley's right, as it goes up, as the ability and momentum created around it gets higher, more profile, more funded, more successful, the more that will start to have a feed-in effect. But as an ex-regulator, I don't think litigation is a particularly strong ex-post mechanism for redress. I really don't. I think it's very late in the day. It's often after harm has been caused. It tends to be incredibly costly. It tends not to lead particularly well to lessons learnt and changed behaviours. Most people insure their way out of the risk. I think there are other sticks that might be more effective, speaking as a public policy wonk. Give me a good regulation.
Other sticks being? Example of a couple of other sticks, perhaps?
Transparency is your first port of call. So what is it that you're doing and how does that equate to others? Can I please put asterisks and a huge caveat? When I say transparency, I don't mean some made up list of metrics, but rather a data model that is verified and credible and industry-wide. And I think that has to be top down, or at least industry initiated with verification and independent insight. So it has depth and reliability. Off the back of that, then there are clear standards around what good would look like and tracking towards it. People really criticize regulation with a capital R as being a tool that is used to slow innovation. And my retort has always been, sure, if you don't know how to regulate well. The wrong set of incentives, the wrong set of things to measure, and the wrong set of rules, of course, will always end badly. But well understood, and they can be tiny levers as well. They can be small levers. We've seen it in other sectors, levies to instigate change on social mobility, for instance, transparency around reporting. Actually, it's the transparency that allows for things like litigation to eventually bite because the information is available in the public domain.
To return to something you mentioned earlier, I think both a carrot and a stick is client demands, right? And how clients are thinking about the climate and their legal representation. As you mentioned as well, this is not the biggest part of most firms' work. Most firms could be profitable if they stopped doing their fossil fuels work tomorrow. And not only that, they would then become the firm of the future. And they would have access to a lot of clients that are very interested in making sure that they maintain their green reputation and also are engaging seriously. So clients are something that we're thinking of very seriously. We know already from a number of firms that clients are placing demands on their firms and the types of work that they want their firms to engage in. And we think that both from the perspective of losing clients and also from the perspective of there being this tremendous amount of influx of cash into, let's say, renewables in the U.S. just from the IRA alone, right? There's all of these different ways in which a firm that chooses to be on the front lines of this can benefit from a business perspective. So I love, Sophia, that you've got the angle of, you know, we need to think about the people and planet over profitability. And then I'm always thinking about the fact that it is also quite profitable to be a firm that's on the cutting edge.
It is. You've got to have a sustainable firm in order to make a positive impact. So I think it's vital that we build business models that have a future. Business is not bad. Business creates the ability to pay for a house, buy food, give people purpose to go to work, to do a thing that matters. But we can also do that in a way that's planet and people positive, in addition to being profitable.
This is a fascinating conversation. We haven't even begun to talk about, you know, the impact of government and government decisions or failure of government to step up to this. So that's a whole other podcast. I hesitate to ask you for a call for action because I'm pretty certain I know what Hayley's is going to be, but I'm going to ask her anyway because there are people who might not have heard it. And I think that's really important. But I think it would be good to just get your sense of what you think could happen now. So Hayley, your call to action for both students and law firms is to sign your pledge, I guess, is it?
Yes. Yeah, so we have a pledge for firms and a pledge for students. And our pledge for firms, as I alluded to earlier, is quite clear. Stop doing the fossil fuels work, full stop. We know that firms with their tremendous amount of assets are able to make a huge impact, and that's something that they can do. Our pledge for students, and we're thinking about expanding it to individual attorneys as well, but currently our pledge for students is different because we've talked about the external pressures that are on students. Many, many students, either because they have six figures in debt in the US or because they are required to get a training contract in the UK or for whatever other reason, really just don't have the option to say, I will never work for a firm that's doing any amount of fossil fuels work. And so what we ask of students is to say, to the extent that it's possible, I will avoid working for a firm that's doing this work. But if my financial or personal circumstances don't allow for me to turn down an offer, what I'm going to do is spend as much time as I possibly can trying to figure out how to move that firm in a positive direction. And we're always excited to connect with folks that are inside firms, and I don't care if their firm is an A firm or an F firm. We've connected with many attorneys across the spectrum and will continue to do so, and are very excited to have those conversations.
That's brilliant. Thank you, Helen. It's really good to see that there's something very positive that young people can do within firms. Sophia, what would your call be to your colleagues in the wider sector?
Don't be afraid to come and be part of this conversation. So I know it can be scary when you're faced with a pledge in activism, but actually, as Hayley said, the future of law firms, future of any organisation, is dependent upon having a pathway or a roadmap to a future that isn't fossil dependent. So take the plunge and have a conversation internally. And if you don't already have a set of principles to help people navigate, just understand the impact that you're having and then make an informed choice. I'm not saying which way that choice should be, but act from a position of knowledge and power and give people a voice and understand what your people internally are asking of you and what your clients want from you. Be the bridge between now and the future that I think we would all agree we'd want.
Fabulous. Thank you both. I mean, very thoughtful, as I would have expected, and purposeful advice from you both. Fascinating conversation. So much more to be said, and I'm sure we'll come back to this. And Hayley, perhaps when your UK report comes out, we can loop back into you and see if any of the UK firms made it into the A-list. But in the meantime, thank you both, Hayley and Sophia, for being my guests today. And thank you for listening to the podcast. Please follow us on the Legal Sustainability Alliance's website and LinkedIn, where you can get updates on the series and you can get links to all the episodes. And if you like what you hear, can I encourage you to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. My thanks to our producer, Beth, and to Ed from 212 Radio for the podcast production. And for now, goodbye.